Now we're getting into the real stuff here in the book of Revelation, the beasts and all that. And you're probably well aware of the fact that there is in evangelical circles a tremendous amount of speculation in this area of who is the beast and what does it represent. And I might just refer to two that have been called to my attention. One by a scholar about 50 years ago. He was quite certain that the League of Nations, supported by the papacy, was the fulfillment of this prophecy. And so convinced was he that he was even in doubt that he would ever be able to publish his book. Well, the book was published, and 50 years went by, and the League of Nations died, and nothing to justify his alarm had happened. You're probably aware of the rather well-known Hal Lindsey, who takes Rome, the common market, and all of this in recent history to be a revived Roman Empire and the foreshadowing of the final coming of one with whom Hitler would compare as a mere choir boy in comparison. And this is by no means unique to the 20th century. This has been going on long, long ago. Back in the Reformation, some thought on the Roman Catholic side that Luther was the fulfillment, and Luther thought that Rome was, and so on it goes. So there's a lot of things that could be said, but I'm not going to rehearse all the varied opinions. I'm simply going to try to give you some of the background and explain some of the reasons why I'm quite convinced in the line that we've been taking that what we are really looking at here is a prophetic symbolic representation of the fourth world empire of Daniel's prophecy, which is none other than the mighty Pax Romana, the Roman Empire. Now, if you look first of all back in Daniel chapter 7, that is the place to begin. And we'll notice a number of very close parallels. We're not going to read all of it word for word. We're going to skim a little, but you'll get the point. Daniel chapter 7, verse 2. Daniel said, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven churning up the great sea." Point number one of identity, the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. I would take that to mean out of the same sea, four different beasts. The first was like a lion. The second was like a bear, verse 5, 6. The third looked like a leopard. And then, verse 7, a fourth beast, terrifying, frightening, and very powerful. The last part of that verse, different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. And you can follow that on through the prophecy of Daniel. And in verse 23 we read, "He gave me this explanation, the fourth beast is a fourth kingdom that will appear on the earth. It will be different from all the other kingdoms, and will devour the whole earth, trampling it down and crushing it. The 10 horns are 10 kings who will come from this kingdom." And it says that in verse 25, "He will speak against the Most High, oppress His saints, try to change the set times and the laws. The saints will be handed over to Him for a time, times, and half a time." Now, if you quickly compare that with Revelation chapter 13, you'll notice that the 10 horns are there, You'll notice that the sea is there. Verse 1, I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, and he had 10 horns. You'll also notice that he makes war with the saints. Verse 7, he was given power to make war against the saints and to conquer them. He has a mouth speaking great things, as you will see. Verse 5, the beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies, and to exercise his, meaning Satan's, authority for 42 months, which we've already seen is parallel to that time, times and a half time. And you will also notice that this beast of the book of Revelation combines within itself the characteristics or has certain points of resemblance with those very three kingdoms which Daniel says preceded. But there's one very significant difference. Did anyone notice what it is? Well, it's reverse order. In Daniel, it's lion, bear, then leopard. In Revelation, it's leopard, bear, then lion. And it's quite easy to see why. Daniel was looking forward, and as he looked forward in time, that was the order. First came the leopard, then came the bear, then came the lion, and then came the nondescript beast, the fourth world empire. Daniel looking back, John looking back, out of the very midst of the fourth beast, naturally sees the same three, but in reverse order. It's quite clear why that is reversed. But it clearly indicates, as indeed does the first vision of Daniel, that this last world empire gathers up into itself features from the preceding empires. It doesn't say that this fourth beast is in every respect like any of these. It had feet like the bear. It had a mouth like a lion. It, in a way, resembled the leopard, but it was different in that the dragon gave the beast, this final one, his power, his throne, and great authority. That is not said of any predecessor. And you'll remember Daniel's vision, the head of gold, and so on. No. The satanic element was by no means so strong in the precursor kingdoms. Now, you will also notice that in modern and popular folklore, this is associated with the Antichrist. And there is a kind of general assumption that the Antichrist is, number one, yet future, and number two, a Superman figure. I won't take time to do anything more than briefly remind you that this is a invalid assumption. It's a thing that permeates the air as it has for centuries, just because it's always been a popular view, but it does not have a biblical foundation. 2 John, please look at 2 John. Verse 7. Many deceivers who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh have gone out into the world. Any such person is the deceiver and the Antichrist. 1 John 2 verse 7, many deceivers have gone out into the world. Any such person is the deceiver and the Antichrist. And what is so impressive there is that in the Greek language, Second John verse 7, I'm sorry about that, please accept my apology. Any such person is the deceiver and the antichrist. The definite article is used in the Greek. It does not say any such person is an antichrist. It does not say that. It says is the antichrist. Now please quickly look at 1 John 2. 1 John, and this is really right this time. 1 John 2, verse 18. Dear children, this is the last hour, and as you have heard that the Antichrist is coming, even now many Antichrists have come. That phrase you have heard, you should be kind of familiar with that now from Matthew. That's a biblical phrase for you've been misinformed by a wrong tradition. That's what it really means. You've heard this, that the Antichrist is coming. Even now, he says, many antichrists have come. This is how we know it is the last hour. And who are they? Well, they went out from us. The antichrists were many, not one. And the fact that there were many proves that it's the last hour. So this modern idea that there's a last hour after the last hour, when the big one will come, does not hold water. Look also at verse 23. Verse 22. Who is the liar? It is the man who denies that Jesus is the Christ. Such a man is the Antichrist. Well, again, it's any man who does that. Any man who denies the true biblical doctrine of Christ, any such man is the Antichrist. And then chapter 4 carries this idea on and says many false prophets have gone out into the world, and this is how we recognize which is the Spirit of God and which is the Spirit of the Antichrist. It's what they say about Jesus. And that's how he says, this is the spirit of the Antichrist, which you have heard is coming. Well, he says, even now, it is already in the world. So I just detour for a moment on that, because you people, like myself, and all the other people I've ever met in 33 years in the ministry, have been influenced by this common misconception that there is a future Antichrist. Well, there is not a future Antichrist. There may be many antichrists, as there certainly were already in John's day, but that there will be one great big antichrist someday, by and by in the future, is a false teaching. It's an incorrect analysis of the Bible. Another thing that is commonly assumed is that the antichrist of John is one and the same with the man of sin in 2 Thessalonians. I got that one right, Doris. 2 Thessalonians. But of course that is not true either. There is no biblical foundation whatsoever for the common assumption that man of sin, 2 Thessalonians, and Antichrist, 1 and 2 John, are identical. There's not the slightest basis for that. It's a pure assumption based on the influence of this false tradition. Furthermore, there is no biblical basis for thinking that the man of sin in 2 Thessalonians is future either, because there are all kinds of time clues in that passage to show that it is not future. Let me show you a few. Paul says, "Don't let anyone deceive you that the day of the Lord has already come," is the issue, because some have been saying the day of the Lord has already come. The NIV is very good there, by the way. It accurately translates that Greek word. That's in verse 2. Saying that the day of the Lord has already come. That's NIV. If you have King James, you'll know that the word is at hand. It's not a good translation. See, the King James isn't always right either. The King James says, is at hand. Well, that's not what the Greek says. The Greek says exactly what the NIV says. He says in verse 2, you're not to be easily unsettled or alarmed by some prophecy or report or letter supposed to have come from us, saying that the day of the Lord has already come. Don't let anyone deceive you in any way, for that day will not come until the rebellion occurs and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the man doomed to destruction. He will oppose and will exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, so that he sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. Don't you remember that when I was with you, I used to tell you these things? And now catch the time references. And now you know what is holding him back. Doesn't say what will hold him back in 1950 or 60 or 70 or 80. It says what is holding him back, so that he may be revealed at the proper time. For the secret power of lawlessness, note please, is already at work. But the one who now holds it back will continue to do so till he is taken out of the way. Then the lawlessness one will be revealed, whom the Lord will overthrow with the breath of his mouth and destroy by the splendor of his coming. The coming of the lawless one will be in accordance with the work of Satan, displayed in all kinds of counterfeit miracles, signs, and wonders, and in every sort of evil that deceives those who are perishing. They perish because they refuse to love the truth and so be saved. Now, if you analyze 2 Thessalonians 2 and the beast of Revelation 13, and I will add at this point the first beast, because of course there are two, and we'll get to the second one later on. But if you analyze beast number one in Revelation 13 and man of sin in 2 Thessalonians 2 and beast number four in Daniel 7, you will find four points of identity. Here they are. The beast receives the authority from Satan. Now, of course, it's not called beast in 2 Thessalonians. But there isn't any question that the receiving of authority from Satan is there. Because the man of sin, verse 9, the coming of the lawless one will be in accordance with the work of Satan, displayed in all kinds of counterfeit miracles. It is the power of Satan. Second thing is the blaspheming of God's name. You saw that clearly in Daniel 7 under the fourth beast. You see it clearly in Revelation chapter 13, verse 5. The beast was given a mouth to utter proud words and blasphemies. You see it clearly in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. He will oppose, verse 4, and will exalt himself over everything that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. Blasphemy, which is named in Revelation, is fleshed out in a literal way in Thessalonians. Remember that Daniel and Revelation are both apocalyptic books. Symbolic representations. 2 Thessalonians is quite literal. The third point of identity, persecution of the saints and a persecution which prevails for a time. Now, that's clearly stated back there in Daniel chapter 7. If you'd like to check me up there, do that. It's Daniel chapter 7. You should have your finger in there anyway. So should I. But it says in verse 25, he will speak against the Most High and oppress his saints. That's in verse 25 of Daniel 7. And the fourth thing that is quite clear as a point of analogy between them is that this beast, or man of sin, receives the worship of the ungodly pagan world, which is represented by the sea. That is clearly indicated in all. Now, I believe that this clearly establishes the parallel. And the tying link is found without question in my judgment in Matthew chapter 24. As compared with Luke chapter 21. And I'm going to give you a minute to find those two places if you'd like to find them. Now in Matthew 24 verse 15, the Lord said, while he was on earth, to living disciples who had to know what to do when the great hour of trial came, he said, "So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand." In other words, you've got to be careful you don't misunderstand this. "Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." Now you find the same statement in Mark's Gospel, but in Luke's Gospel, which was written for Gentiles, you do not find the same statement, but you find an explanatory way of putting it. In verse 20, Luke 21:20, Luke, writing for Gentiles who just wouldn't understand that, makes it quite plain as follows: "When you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, you will know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. For this is the time of punishment in fulfillment of all that has been written." What a statement. "For this is the time of punishment in fulfillment of all that has been written." Remembering then what Christ said, verse 34 of Matthew 24, "I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened." You can understand why Paul said that to the Thessalonians. You people ought to know that that cannot happen. Christ's second coming cannot possibly happen until what Christ said would take place first has taken place first. See? Now, that's true. Christ said of his second coming, no man knows the hour. That's true. But Paul knew one thing for sure. Paul knew that all those things that Christ had predicted to take place in that generation were going to take place in that generation, and that therefore that had to come to pass first. Otherwise, Christ wouldn't be correct, and he knew that couldn't be. So when he wrote to the Thessalonians and said, "Don't be deceived by a letter or a rumor or report or anything else, as if we've said the day of the Lord has already come. You can't say that," he said, "and you ought to be able to remember what I taught you when I was with you. That cannot happen till all these things are fulfilled." And what is it, the big thing that had to be fulfilled in that generation? Well, it was the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. And that is exactly what 2 Thessalonians 2 is all about. The man of lawlessness who puts himself above everything called God, including the religion of Yahweh, Jehovah, and therefore doesn't hesitate to come and set himself right there in God's temple in Jerusalem as if he himself were God. And that's, of course, exactly what happened when Titus marched into Jerusalem and put the ensigns of the Roman government right there in the temple, which was nothing less than asserting the supremacy of Caesar over God. Just the same as Caesar was supreme over the gods of the Sidonians and the god of the people of Tyre and the gods of the Canaanites and the gods of the Egyptians. So he comes in and puts his ensign there, and he is exercising dominion over the God of the Hebrews. See? He opposes and exalts himself over everything that is even called God or worshipped, with the result being that he sets himself up in God's temple, proclaiming himself to be God. Well, what is pictured there, rather literally, is pictured here quite symbolically. So what you see here is, after the dragon has failed in his attempt to destroy God's kingdom on earth by destroying the Messiah, he's failed in that. That was chapter 12. Now verse 17 says he goes off in rage to make war against the rest of her offspring. Well, where are the rest of her offspring? They're scattered around the Roman Empire. That's what Paul's been doing. He's been spreading the gospel. He's been preaching the gospel, starting churches. So now begins the great struggle between Satan and the Gentile church. I almost hesitate to say the Gentile church, but you know what I mean. After the destruction of Jerusalem, the church is predominantly Gentile. That's what I mean. And the arena of conflict moves away from Jerusalem to the Roman Empire, where the great struggle ends in the victory of Christ over the beast. And there can hardly be any doubt about this because of the remarkable parallels between Daniel and this part of Revelation. So what is happening here is that the dragon comes, Satan, and he is now going to use the imperial power and might of Rome as his instrument to try to crush the church. And anybody that knows anything about Christian history knows that that's precisely what happened. So this beast combines within himself the power and authority of Satan and the great empires of the world. I might remind you of Revelation 2:13, which shows us how close this is to even the literal part of this book. For in writing to the church in Pergamum, the Lord said, "These are the words of him who has the sharp double-edged sword." That's the sword that goes forth to conquer the Roman Empire. "I know where you live, where Satan has his throne. Yet you remain true to my name. You did not renounce your faith in me, even in the days of Antipas, my faithful witness." And Antipas, you remember I explained that to be the one who stands against all, who was put to death in your city, where Satan lives. Where Satan lives and Satan has his throne in John's day and in John's context is Pergamum. Now, listen. In Pergamum, in the days of John, was the Asian headquarters of the cult of emperor worship. Caesar was worshipped as the incarnate God. The first temple of the cult of Caesar worship was located at Pergamum in 29 BC. The second temple was built toward the end of the first century and a third later. The worship of the emperor as divine seems to have begun spontaneously in the eastern provinces of the Roman Empire. But it was taken up by Augustus and then Tiberius and progressively promoted by their successors as a very effective political measure. This cult had very great usefulness as the cement to unify the empire in the struggle of the first century, to give cohesion to that empire. These are the words of a great scholar who studied this history. And it reminds you of the fact that in Daniel's vision, the fourth world empire was like iron and clay mixed together, but it didn't hold together very well. It needed something to glue it together. And here's what one of the great scholars says. The imperial cult had as its primary aim to foster patriotism by providing a symbol of the solidarity and unity of the empire. And while the notorious wickedness of the emperors might for us make this a difficult concept, yet in that era, distance, and don't forget these many provinces were quite distant from Rome, not in our terms, but in their terms, distance lent enchantment to the provincial view of the emperor. Sordid traits or idiosyncrasies retired into the background before the adoration felt for the divinity, which hedged this unseen, powerful figure who was hailed with a mixture of servility and real gratitude as the Savior, as the peace, as the Lord of men. And while we may not appreciate what this could mean, it was a life and death matter. There are records aplenty to show that the imperial state authority of Rome was such that on pain of death, you had to bow and acknowledge the supremacy of Caesar. And if you were not willing to acknowledge the supremacy of Caesar, you were put to death one way or another. You might be thrown to the lions, you might be this or that. Now, if you were willing to bow and acknowledge the supremacy of Caesar, then they would not care two hoots if you went to church on Sunday and worshiped your God, so long as it was subordinate to imperial Rome. The same thing exactly was faced in World War II by some of the missionaries out in Manchuria. When the Second World War started, Japanese came in there and they required Christian churches to bow at Shinto shrines in recognition of the Emperor of Japan as deity. And a lot of Christian people did it, made that compromise on the grounds that that way they could go on preaching the gospel. And one of the most thrilling stories of the Second World War era to me was the story of the Covenanters. J.G. Voss was one of them. And from the first day they resolved in their hearts they would never bow. And because they were so different from the rest, they were left alone. And the rest were required, step by step, to back down on just about everything. And what the state did was, with this first demand, when the Covenanters refused to meet it, they simply declared them no church. And so they were left to go their own way. And they never bowed. But most of the Christians in Manchuria did. This may be, in the minds of some of us here, very, very far away, but if I have any insight at all into what's happening in our country, the growth of state authority is ominously in this direction. I can't agree with President Reagan more than on this point, that centralized government has become almighty and all-powerful and has begun to threaten the spiritual liberties of God's people. And you certainly see it, for one thing, in the realm of Christian education. One of the most amazing movements in America today is the growth of private Christian schools. Praise God for that. You should thank God every day for that fact, because it means there are still Christians in this nation who are not willing to bow before Caesar. And it is, after all, Caesar, that is to say, the state authority, that has relentlessly forced Christian religion out of the schools of this country. That is a fact. Can't be denied. And these people are not willing to bow and say, well, we recognize your supremacy. They're still saying, no, Christ is supreme. And we will not acknowledge the state to be his equal. The state must be his subordinate. And that has always been the distinguishing characteristic historically of the Christian religion, and always will be of authentic Christianity. Indeed, some of the heroes of the faith in this very respect are the people who have withstood the beast-like power of communist governments in China and in Russia. Just this past week, I had a newsletter from Hong Kong, Jonathan Chow, the son of Charles Chow, who's done such great work in translating Reformed works into Chinese language. He translated my catechism books into Chinese. And he says that there are men in prison today in China for one reason. They have not disturbed the peace, they have not harmed anyone, but they have been unwilling to bow before the state authority, which says you have to belong, if you're going to be a Christian, you have to belong to the state-controlled three-self, I think they call it, movement, which is a state-controlled, communist-dominated, so-called Christian church. And these people will not do it. They insist on their house meetings, what they call house churches in China, and they have not bowed down before state authority. So what we really are seeing here in Revelation 13 is the idea of state supremacy. And you can see that a little bit later on. We'll come back to this because we're not going to be through with this chapter tonight, but if you look a little bit later on in the chapter, and we're going to end with this, it'll give you some food for thought. This beast talks for a little bit about the second beast and what he does to give power to the first beast, and we'll explain that later. But this first beast, with the help of the second one, is able, verse 16, to force everyone to receive a mark on his right hand or on his forehead, so that no one could buy or sell unless he had the mark, which is the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Now, if you go back to Deuteronomy chapter 5, you get really the root of that. I don't mean 5, I mean 6. In Deuteronomy 6, we read that tremendous summary of the law in a simple principle. Verse 4, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord our God, is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength." The Bible never says to love your nation, your government, with all your heart, soul, and strength. You're to love God that way. Then right away it says, "These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your heart. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit," and so on. "Tie them for symbols." So you are to have them upon your foreheads and your hands. Verse 8, "Tie them or bind them as symbols on your hands and on your foreheads." Now what that means is that God makes totalitarian claims. When he says it's got to be on your head, he means that your whole thought process has to be controlled by his word, his law. And when he says it's on your hand, he means you have to act in life, in all that you do, in obedience to his law. And what Rome in the first century and communist governments today, and every humanist-dominated government tends in this direction, including our own today. Thank God it hasn't gone that far. But every humanist-dominated culture and government tends in the direction of its own totalitarianism. And it says, you have to think our way and act our way. And what's so ominous is that there is such an enormous erosion of the influence of the Christian faith. It's being shunted out of the public domain more and more. That's the desire of the humanists, into the private domain, just exactly like ancient Rome. Caesar couldn't care less if you had Christianity as your private thought, as long as you were willing publicly to say Caesar is supreme. And whatever Caesar says, that I'll do. A teacher in a public school today should not teach evolution as the truth. They should teach creation as the truth and get kicked out if necessary. But not many are courageous enough to do it. That's the issue. See? That's what it's all about. And somebody in public life should judge according to a law above the law of man. That's the way it should be. And senators and people in public office should get up and speak out of what God's law requires of men. I had in my home in New Zealand one time a member of the Dutch Parliament who does exactly that. He says, they usually won't listen, but at least they've heard it. On issues like homosexuality and abortion, he gets up and he says, men, you're going to answer to God someday. He says this right in the Dutch Parliament. Because God says this, and He is the judge of the judges of the earth. And you're not going to get away with it. Now, they don't always listen to it. Sometimes they do. And it was a really inspiring thing to talk to that man. Well, I'm way over time. I'm going to quit there. We'll come back to the middle of this chapter next time.